I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What happens when an artist works side by side with scientists, secretaries, engineers, and planners? Does it make for a more creative workplace and lead to new insights? Two artists who have brought the act of creation into two very different fields are with us to talk about their experiences today. Daniel Mahalio from Seattle was named Artist in Residence at the Seattle Department of Transportation. Chief of Staff for the department, Patrice Gillespie Smith, was his boss, and we'll find out from the two of them how Daniel influenced the work of Seattle's transportation planners. Dan Goods works at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, helping scientists there communicate their mission to a broader public. We'll talk to artist-in-residence Dan Goods and Daniel Mahalio today on Smart City. And we'll find out about the Seed School, where students are in residence, from Stephen Goldsmith. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Stephen Goldsmith is former mayor of Indianapolis and now heads Harvard's Innovations in Government Awards.
This issue of charter schools is one that's being hotly contested around the country, as the number of charter schools has gone from a few a decade ago to thousands today. Lots of researchers are comparing what works to what doesn't work. And the reason that the Seed School in Washington, D.C., won Harvard Innovations Award was because it does something really unique. It creates a public-private partnership. It gives the young adults in D.C. an opportunity for a boarding experience year-round, academy-like, that teaches them skills that they might not have otherwise received.
Eric Adler is co-founder and managing director of the Seed School. Eric, describe the Seed experience for students.
Students first get introduced to Seed when they are in the sixth grade in Washington, D.C., when we go out into the community and introduce ourselves to people in the community who can in turn introduce us to students who would really benefit from this kind of a supportive 24-hour environment. And they come to campus and they find out what the school is like and they get an application on campus. And then they go into a lottery and we choose at random from a population of kids from Washington's poorest neighborhoods. And then they come and live with us starting in the seventh grade. And they live with us for 6 years, in some cases even a little bit longer, if it takes longer for them to meet the academic goals. And then they graduate at the end of their senior year of high school with a diploma that we hope really means that they're prepared for college. And so far it has meant exactly that. Every single graduate of the school has gone on to college.
And how many graduates have you had?
We've had about 35 graduates of the school in 2 years, and those two classes were small classes for us because in our first couple of years when we first took in classes, we were in a rented campus where we didn't have very much space. And we have since moved on to our own campus that we built from the ground up, and we have much more space now, and so we take larger classes. And so as time goes on, we'll be graduating larger classes. This coming year, we'll be graduating about 25 students.
You said they come from Washington's poorest neighborhoods. Is that a requirement?
Well, it's not a requirement in a legal sense or in a legalistic sense, but that's the population of students we're looking to serve, is kids who otherwise wouldn't get a shot at a really great college prep education, and kids who really can benefit from the 24-hour support that Seed is able to offer. So what we have done is we have gone into neighborhoods where we know that there are a lot of kids whose neighborhoods provide an awful lot of distraction, whose schools have not been successful typically, whose parents may be working two or even three jobs and may not be coming home until 11 o'clock at night, so they may not be getting the kind of supervision that they really need and the kind of assistance with homework and other things. So we have really targeted kids where this kind of 24-hour support is likely to make all the difference in their outcomes. If we give them this kind of support, they'll almost certainly do well, and if we don't give them this kind of support, they almost certainly won't.
Tell me about the parents of your students.
Parents run the gambit. We have parents who are very committed to our college prep mission. We have parents who are not. And what they're looking for is simply to know that their child is in a safe, secure environment, and you know that's why they're interested in Seed, and our college prep mission for their children comes secondarily to them. We have parents who are very, very involved and come on campus several times a week and volunteer and are really involved with the school and with their child's education, and we have other parents who aren't able to do that for whatever reasons. But ultimately, what we are trying to do is work with parents to get them involved with this college prep mission so that their students, their children, can see their parents being involved. And because we know that educational outcomes for children are very closely correlated with parental involvement. And so we have this parent resource center that gives parents a reason to come on campus where they can learn computer skills and job skills, and they can get on a computer and get on the internet. We can help parents with various other issues so that we become something of a resource for parents rather than just being this place where their children go to school. We really want to be a resource for the whole family. And one of the statistics that we are most proud of is that in our first class where we actually tracked it, 25% of the parents of our graduating seniors in our first graduating class, 25% of those parents went back to school, either to pursue a GED or, in the case of those who had high school degrees, to actually begin taking college courses.
That's impressive. Of course, you're a boarding school, so that's one way in which you are enormously different from a typical public school. You obviously have smaller classes and a smaller school. What else is different about what you do versus what a good public school would do?
First of all, the issues that you've just mentioned are all just absolutely critical. The boarding program is absolutely critical, I think, to the success of our students, and the small class sizes are absolutely critical, and the small community size is absolutely critical. Those things all, and I really actually want to focus for a minute on that last one, the last community, the size of the community, which is, I think, integral to our focus on shared community values. That's something that we pay a lot of attention to, that I think successful schools have to pay a lot of attention to, is the culture of the community that you build in the school. Students, frankly, at the secondary school level, are going to learn as much from each other as they are going to learn from the adults in the community around them. And so we have got to find ways to make that peer culture be positive. It's simply not possible for adults to undo the effects of a negative peer culture. They've got to create a circumstance where a positive peer culture flourishes, and you can only do that in a small community where everybody knows everybody and knows them by name and knows their parents and knows their siblings and can respond to them when they speak a certain way and say, hold it, I just can't believe that that's what you really mean. I can't believe that you're really proud of failing that test. I can't believe that you really don't care about these things that you say you don't care about. And so we've been able to create a small community where everybody voices the fact that they are sharing the same dream, which is to go to college. And so there is support all the way around the student, everywhere they look for that dream.
Do you think that can only happen in small school settings?
I think that it can almost only happen in small school settings. I think that every once in a while, you can find an administrator who is so talented that they can run a large school that does it successfully. But I think that you're asking the people who run the school to be super talented, superhuman people. I think that if we want to do it in large numbers, I think that we're going to have to do it mostly in smaller schools. If you run a school where students can be 40 yards down a hallway misbehaving, and the adult who sees them doesn't know their name and has no relationship with them, and they know that if they simply duck around the corner, that that adult will have no idea who they were, it's virtually impossible, I think, for adults to have a positive impact then on those students.
Do you recruit your teachers and school leaders from the same pool of people as do public schools?
To a certain extent, we do. We are recruiting from many of the same colleges and universities who have training programs in education. We are recruiting from the D.C. public schools and other public school systems. But we are also recruiting from other places where probably a lot of traditional public school systems are not recruiting. We are recruiting, for example, alumni from Teach for America, and we're recruiting on certain websites. We are recruiting through word of mouth, and we have obviously a network of contacts that some of which probably overlaps with the networks of contacts that a lot of public school systems have, but some of which probably doesn't. We are also recruiting through the teacher placement services that more typically serve independent schools than traditional public schools.
You are operating, of course, in D.C. How does your per pupil expenditure compare to that of the D.C. school system?
Our total spending by the time all is said and done is probably nearly triple what a traditional District of Columbia public school spends. That's not all public money. It is a true public-private partnership. Much of the private money is being raised for purposes of building the campus and ramping up the program from a very tiny program. In our first year, we had 40 students to still not a very big program, but today we have 320 students. But also, we are augmenting the stream of public money that operates the school with privately raised money as well.
Eric Adler is co-founder of the Seed Foundation in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Smart City. Eric, you said you spend three times what D.C. spends per pupil. And the 350 students in your school, of course, are very fortunate to be there, obviously. But at that price, is your model meaningful for education at large? Can it be duplicated? Are there things to be learned? What's the value in the larger scheme of education?
I think that there are several different answers. I'll start with the most philosophical. My observation is that we have allowed our inner city schools to languish for decades. And we've done that at least partly because the political calculus has been it's enormously expensive to work on some of our inner city education problems. And when we look at the spending, it's not even clear that our more expensive urban schools can produce better outcomes than our less expensive suburban and rural schools. So why would we pour all this money into a project that we don't even think is necessarily going to work? Well, I think that one of the most important things about the Seed School in Washington and the other Seed Schools that we are now beginning to work on, but the school in Washington that's up and operating, is that we are proving, I believe, that the properly made investment does pay off. Our students are all going on to college, and they are doing so in large numbers where statistically that same population of students would be expected to go off only in tiny numbers to college. So we are demonstrating that a properly made investment works. But the second thing I would answer is that that investment of getting on toward $30,000 per student per year, it sounds like an awful lot, but the truth of the matter is there are day schools in Washington, D.C., that are spending $30,000 a year per student. They're private, but that's what they spend. Their tuition levels are at $23,000, $24,000, and then they're receiving another $5,000-$6,000 a year from their endowments, and their total operating costs are about the same as ours. Private boarding schools do it on twice what we spend. Typically, they are costing about $60,000 a year per student to operate. But I think the most important comparison is what does the taxpayer get back after making this very meaningful investment in students? We know that the net present cost to society of a high school dropout is about $500,000 over the course of that dropout, taken as a net present value to today. And so when we look at that cost and we look at the rate at which we graduate students from high school versus the rate at which urban students are traditionally graduating from high school, which I have to say a majority of them are not, we are returning money to the taxpayer quite literally the day that the student graduates.
Let me ask you this. This obviously doesn't describe your student population, but I want to ask you a question about the most troubled, the most difficult children in schools. And of course, public schools have to find a way to get them out of the broader school population, but off the streets as well. So that makes it very difficult to find these solutions for these very troubled students. Do you think a seed model is an answer for those students?
I think a seed model can be an answer for some of those students. Every child is different. Every child reacts to a different situation differently. We have some children at Seed who were those students a couple of years ago. And Seed was a solution that allowed them to settle down and to become serious about their lives, their futures, their work. But there are certain elements of the program that have been just critical to them. One example is that Seed is a school of choice. That's terribly important for our students' success. Nobody has been locked in. Nobody is forced to be there. That would be a completely different environment for us. So I don't know the extent to which if you created a program, say, in the juvenile justice system that looked something like Seed, to what extent could that be successful with students? Well, that would be somewhat different from what we do because it would not necessarily be a school of choice. Students might be assigned there. And I think that that might have implications for how the program runs. But I do believe that there are students who are currently probably real distractions in their to their traditional public schools in the classroom, who, if given a setting like SEED, could do very well and could go on to college and do very well in college and lead very happy and successful lives, getting to be whatever they want to be.
You said you are planning SEED schools in other cities. Where is next?
I don't know yet where next is. I can tell you some of the places we're working, and I don't yet know in which order they will come to fruition. We are working on a new campus here in Washington, D.C., on which we are expecting to build a facility for 600 additional beds. We are working toward opening a school in Maryland, in Baltimore, and that one we hope is coming on the horizon soon. We are also working in other cities. We're working on the West Coast, in L.A. and in Oakland, where, again, we've received some very nice warm support, and we are looking forward to going forward with those projects.
We need all the signs of success we can get in urban schooling, and I'm glad you are showing the way, Eric. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Eric Adler is co-founder and managing director of the SEED School. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Trained equally in architecture and the studio arts, Daniel Mahalio says he practically leapt at the opportunity to help shape the outcome of public art in the right of way when he was offered the opportunity to become the Seattle Department of Transportation Artist in Residence. As an arts advocate, urban enthusiast, author, and architect-trained native of Seattle, he saw an unusual opportunity to redefine the parameters for creativity in the Seattle pedestrian environment. Patrice Gillespie-Smith is chief of staff for the Seattle's Department of Transportation, the agency that builds, manages, and operates the city's $8 billion transportation system and manages the Artist in Residence program. Patrice, why does a Department of Transportation have an artist in residence?
Well, we maintain more public space than any other entity in the city, and we take that role pretty seriously. Every day, residents, employees, visitors are interacting with our public space, probably more than any other entity's space in the city. So if we can make that a more pleasant experience, we're going to do it.
Daniel, how did you come to hold that position in the Department of Transportation in Seattle?
Well, the Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs in Seattle, which has been around since the early 70s and has been a pioneer in the public art realm in the nation, put out a call in 2003 for an artist in residence at the Department of Transportation. And the open call interested me just from an urban planning standpoint and from a public art standpoint and from an architecture standpoint. And so I read the call carefully and decided that I would go for it. So I made an application and went through the interview process and was selected for it.
Tell me about your work as an artist.
My work is pretty multidisciplinary. I do site-specific installation art. I do studio artwork in terms of painting, drawing, small tabletop sculpture, and also architecture work that sometimes crosses the boundaries into artwork as well. So it's sort of crossing a lot of different disciplines.
Patrice, I know you've been placing art in spaces shared with transportation for many years. I remember years ago going and having my picture made on the troll under the bridge. I'm sure many people tell you that. But in 2003, was that the first time you had actually invited an artist in residence for the Department of Transportation?
Yes, we wanted to formalize that role because we know that while we can think about it with communities, we don't often take a proactive approach.
What did you hope to accomplish with an artist-in-residence approach? If it were successful, what would be the outcome?
If we were successful, and I do believe we are, we would be able to have our employees consider art early on in the process. Unfortunately, it just doesn't work well when we come into it at the very last minute and say, hey, what do you think about putting a piece of art here? Or what do you think about changing this aesthetically? So if we approach this appropriately, and I think we did, is we're trying to get the entire department to change its orientation so that they're thinking about art before we start constructing.
Daniel, were you well received by the employees there? Did people welcome you and cooperate with you? Did they understand how to work with you?
The department has 1,000 or so employees, and I interviewed about 125 over the course of about a year-long investigation period. And I actually didn't find anybody in the department who was not open to the idea, and some were really enthusiastic about the idea of getting an artist and a sort of art contribution into the Department of Transportation. So I was very well received. And in fact, some of the best thought that went into the plan came from employees who actually had been thinking about these very same issues for years.
What did you hope to accomplish when you were selected to be the artist in residence? What difference did you think you could make?
Public art nationwide really is known for its standalone sculpture that is in very public locations. And I had long felt that there needed to be even more diversity in terms of what can go in the public right-of-way in terms of artwork. And so I thought that this would be a great opportunity to sort of explore that public realm and consider what other types of artwork could be there. I'm a big fan of the pedestrian Seattle landscape, and I think that there's a lot of opportunity out there for all kinds of art forms to take place. And so I thought this would be a great platform to sort of investigate that idea.
Does the Department of Transportation, Patrice, control the sidewalks?
Yes, we do. We have more than 500 miles of sidewalks throughout the city.
So, Daniel, when you were developing your plan or your approach, you could actually take sidewalks into consideration.
Oh, yeah. Sidewalks are one of the primary areas where we can contribute. But really, it's anything from building face to building face. And it's about, well, depending on where you're measuring, it's like over 30% of the gross area in the downtown urban core is that public right-of-way. And so it includes everything on the sidewalk as well, including the street furniture and the telephone poles and any of the utility cabinets that are there.
When you say more diversity, what do you mean by that?
In terms of diversity of artwork, like typically most public artwork is a large standalone sculpture. So there might be opportunities to get the work of poets, the work of small two-dimensional artists who can get work out mounted on poles. It could be opportunities for masons to do craft-oriented work, opportunities for metal fabricators, opportunities for performance art. So there's really a whole range of artwork that can actually go in that right-of-way that is not often represented.
You mentioned poetry. You proposed a project, Poetry on Poles. Tell me about that project.
That's an opportunity for poets to apply their gifts and get their work out in the right-of-way. So it's an opportunity where poetry is submitted for a juried process and work is selected, and then it would be placed inside of a small lit cabinet that would be mounted to a pole. And the actual cabinet would be made from a salvaged fire pole box and placed in several pedestrian-heavy downtown locations. And the poetry would be rotated every other month or so.
I know you worked on an art plan for the Department of Transportation in Seattle. Did you also work on art?
The open call for this whole project involved an opportunity to have a pilot project. So while I was working in the Department of Transportation, I was looking at all kinds of upcoming capital improvement projects that were coming down the pipeline. And I was asked to take a look at all those that were coming and to select one that might be a good example or represent the sort of ideas that are going to be in the plan and put them to action. So one of those actually that I was looking at quite carefully was a pedestrian bridge over a very busy street, over the train tracks into a park on the waterfront in Seattle.
The plan you developed for the Seattle Department of Transportation is very detailed. Did you have that planning experience in your background, or was this something completely new to you?
It is something totally new to me. I had written a book, actually, back in 1997 on the subject of the sawmill architecture of the Pacific Northwest. So the process of sort of going in and looking at a totally different history of a culture and then writing about it was not foreign to me. But the Department of Transportation in Seattle was a completely new entity, and I really wasn't familiar with the public process and some of the workings of the city. So it was a huge learning curve going into it. But in many ways, it's the same, just researching as much as you possibly can and trying to find all of the opportunities that are out there and exploring them.
Patrice, I assumed you helped Daniel along in this process. Did you have any format? Had other departments in city government there completed a similar plan so you had a model or a template to go by?
Well, actually, Daniel did a great job of driving this process for us. As he mentioned, he interviewed so many people throughout the department that he had a very good sense of the resources we had on hand and some of the problems we're facing for maintenance, which he knew he could address by giving us solutions through art.
I wouldn't mind commenting on that as well. the Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs has done a great job at getting artists in the public utilities around the city, and there had been previous work by other artists in the water department and the sewer department and the electrical department. So there had been precedents. This plan did differ quite a bit from those previous plans in that artists in those other utilities were working in the agencies looking for opportunities specifically for large-scale public artwork, and typically those had been for that artist in residence. The charge for this plan was quite a bit different. I was to go into the Seattle Department of Transportation and just explore all the opportunities and sort of really re-look at how we can do public artwork in the right of way, and it was really to bring up a whole new system of ideas for getting different types of artwork and for exploring those opportunities instead of developing single projects.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Daniel Mihalio, who is artist in residence with the Seattle Department of Transportation, and Patrice Gillespie-Smith, who is the chief of staff in that department. I want to talk a little bit more about the specific ideas in your plan, because, again, I thought they were very inventive. I loved your idea, Daniel, for the Bridge Tower residences. Tell me what you had in mind there.
There is a new bridge replacement project in the Fremont neighborhood in Seattle, which is not too far from the Fremont Troll, very famous public artwork. That bridge replacement project is going to actually keep the center portion of the bridge the same, and it's a historic structure, and it's really these big concrete ramp approaches that are going to be replaced. There are these four control towers that are on the bridge. Only one of them is used by a bridge tender who operates what they call the bascule bridge movement for the bridge to let the ships go underneath. The other three towers have been vacant for many years and used as storage, and actually one of them had a Davy Jones locker sort of piece of furniture where he found a beautiful set of original blue line prints of the bridge. So they're quite nice structures. They have great light. They're up high, and they've got a perfect view of the waterway and the Fremont neighborhood, and it seemed like a perfect opportunity to get a writer or a painter to be able to occupy or have access to the space for 1 month during the summer to be able to produce work. So the plan is to have two artists every year, 1 month at a time, in one of these bridge towers to be able to do different kinds of work.
I thought the idea for the residencies was wonderful. I also liked your idea for the signal box poster grants. These signal boxes, they're everywhere in cities. They're usually covered with crumbling street posters. They're a real mess, real eyesore, but you had a different idea. Tell me about it.
Yes, those cabinets do appear around the nation, and a lot of cities use different types. The one that we have in Seattle is actually a very clean and modern object. It's aluminum, and it comes off the factory floor very shiny, and it lasts on the city streets probably about 3 or 4 months before it starts to receive a lot of graffiti. The city spends a fair amount of money every year maintaining these types of surfaces and stripping the graffiti and posters for rock shows. So looking at opportunities for getting artwork in the right-of-way, I thought that using that same system that we have on the sides of the Metro bus in town where you slide in a panel on a spring clip type of system, that we could use that same system on the side of the signal control cabinet and have an opportunity for the Seattle Department of Transportation along with the Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs to print up artwork by artists in Seattle in a short-run poster format and have them mounted on these signal control cabinets on a rotating basis again so that the artwork can be refreshed if it's destroyed by graffiti and or by weather, and it can constantly bring more opportunities for emerging artists to get their artwork out on the right of way and keep the signal control box cabinets clean and free of graffiti.
Patrice, I can't believe you don't have some traffic engineers, you know, who must be thinking, yeah, art, sure, but, you know, what we're really about is building roads and doing signalization and, you know, the real stuff that keeps the traffic moving. So
I should say, when Daniel first presented his plan, part of the success of it was showing that you don't have to spend a lot of extra money and effort to incorporate art into our infrastructure. We manage more than $8 billion worth of infrastructure. And, you know, yes, you do have some people that are very practical, but that was part of the success of his proposal, was that let's back up and let's look at ways that we could actually save money in the long run. For instance, his idea about putting art on traffic control boxes, that actually could in the long run save us money, because we do spend millions of dollars every year trying to undo what others have done to our infrastructure, whether it be graffiti, postering, or even damage overall, if you can get a neighborhood to embrace these very functionary pieces of infrastructure throughout their area, that we could actually reduce our maintenance cost.
When Daniel did his sidewalk survey of public art in Seattle, he identified an amazing wealth of work. How did it get there, Patrice? And do you ever face the challenge of crowding, where the art begins to encroach on the purpose of the sidewalk, which is to allow people to move freely back and forth?
Well, Carol, yeah, clearly our priority is safety, and so we do have to be concerned with clutter. But Seattle is a city of neighborhoods, and oftentimes we have neighborhoods come to us say, you know, we'd really like to capture the essence of our neighborhood by putting something on the public infrastructure, whether it's dancing feet in the Broadway sidewalks or benches in our Belltown neighborhood. It's something that tells neighbors and visitors this is what our neighborhood is about.
Daniel, as an artist, what do you think you brought to this assignment that, let's say, an arts administrator who could have done the plan would not have brought to the assignment?
Well, I think coming back to the idea of the sort of history of public art, which is really based around really notable outdoor public installations of large-scale sculpture, I think the main contribution I bring to this plan is sort of scaling back the vision of what public art can be into something more small-scale and intimate. Some of my favorite experiences in a pedestrian environment are those that only I can see, say, standing next to a telephone pole, and I see someone came out and pasted a piece of poetry on that pole, and only I am reading that poem. And that experience, you're in this incredibly public place, but you're having this very personal experience. I have always cherished those moments, and so I thought that given that the right-of-way is sort of a cluttered environment already, that maybe we can really get more work out there as long as it's the scale is kept small and the experiences are kept rich, that we can really improve that experience.
It's an interesting point you make, because you don't often think about public art in a very small scale, and yet you found some very interesting examples of small-scale public art in Seattle, in the public rights of way, or also in the sort of the public-private realm, if you will. Were you surprised by that?
I wasn't surprised to find it. I've always been looking for those things. And when I travel to different cities, it seems like those are the things that always jump out at me. So it seems that I've kept an eye on it. And just being a lover of the urban environment, that's just something that I've always carried with me. I photograph those things wherever I go. And when this opportunity came up, I thought this is a great time to sort of explore this idea further.
My guess is once your plan gets in circulation, there will be a lot of cities looking to copy what you've done. Patrice, do you get inquiries from other cities in terms of how your program works and whether it can be duplicated?
To date, not yet, but I think you're correct in that once people get the word, they will be contacting our department.
When you look at the plan, it's so full of new ideas and fresh ideas and lots of them. Do you worry at all, Daniel, about how all of this comes together and if everything were executed, whether it would be just sort of sensory overload, too much?
The plan actually takes some care in sort of trying to be somewhat prescriptive about how much artwork is actually installed, such as the downtown core really has got quite a lot of artwork already. And there are portions of this plan that try to encourage artwork to be put in some of the outlying neighborhoods that don't receive a lot of public infrastructure dollars in terms of transportation dollars or Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs public art money. And Seattle's, you know, a pretty big city, and there are a lot of neighborhood downtown areas that could use a lot of improvement in terms of public art. So there's, I think, there would be many decades of opportunities for artists before the right-of-way would ever become cluttered.
What do you think were the most important insights you brought to the work for the Seattle Department of Transportation?
I brought a unique perspective in the terms of I have an architecture background, and so I have that love of public places and the public environment at sort of a larger scale. So I had a sort of a somewhat bigger view than maybe just a public artist might have had, and that came in handy in many instances in the department where I was able to communicate sort of as a peer with a lot of the project managers who work on large budgets, very complex projects, and I was able to understand sort of where they're coming from and their issues in terms of budgeting and schedule and contractors and make observations and contributions to that sort of working process that might help get art in the right of way where maybe just an an ordinary public artist might not have that sort of background in construction.
Daniel Patrice, thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Mahalio is artist in residence at the Seattle Department of Transportation. Patrice Gillespie-Smith is chief of staff for the agency. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation on the impact of artist in residence with artist Dan Goods from the Jet Propulsion Labs. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Creating a pipe organ out of soda pop bottles, gardening at the Huntington Gardens, and designing four-dimensional objects led Dan Goods to his current position at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. There, he's developing ways of communicating JPL missions to the general public. He's been working with the Terrestrial Planet Finder mission, which hopes to find another planet like Earth. Dan, I've been telling audiences that the real power of art and creativity to a community is to break them out of the silo of art and get them into and influencing other parts of the community. As an artist, you've done that, working with scientists at Caltech and the Jet Propulsion Lab. How did working in science settings influence your work?
Well, I think one of the things I noticed the most was that a lot of scientists seem to think the same way or in similar threads as artists do. People tend to think that there's such a chasm between the two, and I find that that's not necessarily the case. And I think that's probably been one of the biggest influences on me, is just kind of seeing how a scientist will dream big, amazing types of things, like at the Jet Propulsion Lab and also at Caltech. The type of work that they're imagining is futuristic, and it's beyond something that you normally think about in your daily walk around the park.
Do you ever try to break it down and think about it in a way that says our work or our approach to work is alike in these ways, or is it more an impressionistic sense of being influenced by the scientist and I would imagine vice versa?
Well, I suppose a little bit of both. So artists and scientists both do similar things in that they explore, they tinker. When you talk about experimenting or exploring different possibilities, those are both things that the artists and the scientists do. It's just that they're in different communities.
Do you think there's value to be realized from putting these two communities together in close proximity physically on some sort of regular basis that then results in more understanding or different kinds of work or better sorts of work? I mean, what's the outcome of your being in such close proximity with scientists or people who are not artists?
Well, I definitely think that the collaboration between the two is really important. Innovation always comes out of seeing something from different perspectives. And whenever you have more perspectives in the room, then the more opportunities you have to innovate. And for the most part, everyone that I've talked to whenever I've been either at JPL or Caltech, they've always said, I can't believe we have someone like you here, and it's such an amazing thing. They're always excited to have someone like me. And when I've written emails to other people in the community, they've said, oh, I wish every single science institution had an artist there as well.
What do you think the scientists get from your being there?
I think it's mainly a fresh perspective, because as much as you may think that you are thinking out of the box, when you have someone from a different world there, then they can see how much of a box they actually have.
Do you think this kind of in-residence idea, it works only for a visual artist? I mean, could you put a musician, could you put a dancer, could you put a writer in a science setting and have the same sort of exchange and influence on each other's work? Or do you think there's something?
No, I think what you said at the beginning is true, that you could put any artist who's really interested in the actual work of the scientists from any field can have a positive and fruitful impact on that particular scientist or that institution. An area that I've had interest in the past is information design. What happens is that scientists collect tons of data, and especially nowadays as we're getting higher resolution cameras and more sensitive instruments, they collect so much data that they don't know how to deal with it. And visual artists particularly have had a lot of experience in the past of organizing information, but musicians as well. And so I know that there are musicians working with genomic data. So instead of seeing the enormously long strings of DNA as little letters, you would listen to that instead. And I know of artists dealing with radio astronomy. So giant telescopes are bringing back radio signals from other planets and quasars and pulsars, and musicians are taking that data and making music with them and giving the scientists another perspective on the data that they kind of look at every single day.
Was your first contact with scientists in these situations awkward?
Well, I think at the beginning I was trying to figure out the same questions that you had asked me earlier of, well, is my being here going to be beneficial to them or am I wasting their time? And I think they were also sort of wanting that same sort of thing. Fortunately, I'd gone into a situation where an artist had already established himself and the people around him really respected him. And so I had a little bit easier time blending in.
Was there a pattern set up in the beginning? In other words, was there a formal introduction and, okay, Dan, you present this and the scientists will present that, and that began to get the relationship off in an organized way, or was it more organic?
My first experience was a little bit more structured. I went to Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, which is really close to the California Institute of Technology. And both the presidents of those schools knew each other and knew that there should be some sort of collaboration between the two. Caltech already had a research fellowship for undergrads from other schools around the world to come and do research during the summer. And they opened that up to Art Center students. So I was one of the first to be a part of that. And I had known of this one particular artist already that was working in a biological imaging center. And I called him up and said, is there anything that I can do for you? And so he had some ideas on what I could work on.
Mm-hmm. What about the assignment appealed to you?
Well, first off, what they were trying to do is create an atlas of a mouse and a living organism. And that was pretty interesting, but they really want to make an atlas over time. So it's not just a static thing. The atlas would grow depending on how old the mouse was. So that seemed pretty interesting. But the work that this particular artist asked me to do was he wanted me to look into transparency and iridescence as ways of displaying lots of information, because they wanted to map a lot of information onto this mouse atlas. So what we decided to do was for me to look into water, because water shows a lot of different types of information. If you look at the surface of the water, you see the texture of it, you see reflections, you see refractions. When you get into the middle of the water, you can see objects within the water. The bottom of the water also has another layer of data. There's all these shadows and beautiful lighting aspects of water. And so my research was to swim like an otter for a half an hour a day, and then take pictures and movies and just kind of explore things that were transparent and iridescent. And when I first heard about doing something like that, it got me really excited. And I threw myself into the whole process. And what I did was I collected a whole lot of visual information, not necessarily thinking about the final product, but after a period of time, I had a bunch of visual information that I could refer to and say, well, what if this bubble, instead of actually being a bubble, represented a gene expression? Or what if this streak in the water represented the way a gene traveled throughout the body? And so then I would take those specific analogies and then apply them to an interface.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dan Goods. He's an artist who's worked with Caltech and NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. You were talking about your work, Dan, and I'm glad that you've transitioned to that, because I want to let you talk about your work. But you have to tell me, what does it mean to swim like an otter?
If you've ever seen an otter, they don't tend to swim laps. You know, when you go to a swimming pool, everyone swims laps. But an otter plays. They play in the water, and they flip upside down, and they go sideways. And when you do this in a pool of people swimming laps, you tend to kind of get some interesting looks. But what's great at a place like Caltech is you can say, well, I'm doing research. And then they all go, oh, wow, okay, that's great. You know, better science. Go ahead, do that. Yeah, so the idea was that I'm not really a swimmer. That's not something that's in my background. It was really difficult for me. But the idea was to put me into an environment that was completely new to me so that I could see the water in a much different way.
Tell me more about your work.
When I went to Art Center College of Design, I studied graphic design. And graphic design, normally you think of doing logos or posters or websites and that sort of thing. But I had a particular instructor that he was kind of like Yoda. You'd ask him, well, how do I do a Nike ad? He'd sit there and he's an old Chinese fellow, and he would tell you about the Roman Empire. He'd tell you about Atlantis. He'd tell you about the history of money. And 20 minutes later, you didn't really know what he said, but you knew what you were supposed to do, and he never talked about shoes. And what he did with me is he really tried to make me think about new ways of communicating ideas. So when someone would come back with a solution at school that would be a normal poster or something like that, in the critique, he would transform that poster into something that was physical and in the environment and something that you never would have thought about before, but it made so much more of an impact. And so as I was thinking about the different missions that the Jet Propulsion Lab has been involved in, that's what I tried to do. One of the missions is called the Terrestrial Planet Finder Mission, and it's kind of a lot of words, and to describe it is really kind of confusing, the specific technology, but the basic idea is that they're looking for planets around other stars. To me, if they were to find another planet like Earth around another star, it would make a fundamental shift in our understanding of ourselves and the universe that we live in. And so to me, that particular mission meant a lot to me. Like I said, the technology is really difficult to understand, but the basic idea is that they're trying to block out a really bright light, a star, to see a really dim light, a planet. And a planet orbiting around another star is like 5 billion times dimmer than the star that you're looking at. So when we look up in the sky, all we see are little dots. But really, there might be planets going around these, and about 150 have been found so far outside of our solar system. And so taking that basic idea of blocking out a bright light to see a dim light, I had this idea where I would get a giant spotlight, and I'd shine it against a big wall or a screen that would be maybe 25 feet wide by 12 or 15 feet tall. And at the same time, I'd project a movie onto that wall. But you can't see the movie because this light is so overpowering. It's kind of like you're in a conference room and someone has lights on. It's a little hard to see the projection, but many, many times more powerful. And so when people walk up to this installation, they don't see anything. All they see is a white wall, and they may hear some music. But people just have this inherent playfulness where they want to see their shadows really big. And so people kind of jump out and look at their shadows, and then all of a sudden they realize that inside of their shadows is a movie or something's going on inside. And then because the screen is so large, their shadows are really small in that. So all they really see is about a tenth of the movie. So they're kind of forced to go find other people to block out more of the light. And to me, this is a lot of very similar to scientific exploration. A scientist will often kind of trip upon some interesting phenomenon. And so they see this, but they can only see a little bit of it, or they really only understand a little tiny bit of the actual phenomena. So they have to write papers, and then they go tell their colleagues, and then they study and study it until they're able to see more of it. And so I was kind of pleased in the way that people respond to this particular installation because it's very similar to that.
Yeah, they get it. That's a great way to make a scientific concept simple to understand and experienced.
Yeah, exactly. I like it when people can experience the data instead of just kind of reading about it.
Oh, and yeah.
One of my kind of charges was to come up with ways for people to learn about this. I've been trying to make installations that could be put in places that you would never quite expect to see something from a science institution like that. So I've been able to put these into music festivals and other types of public locations that are not science centers, and they're not, you know, the entryway of a, you know, a big science institution, so that normal people just kind of going about their normal daily life can learn about this.
It's interesting you say that, Dan. That's thought a lot about we are science illiterate in the U.S., and you start to think, how can you make scientific concepts understood in the course of daily life? Everything we do, everything we encounter is based on science. And you think if you could sort of make those things transparent and make their workings transparent, it would at least begin to educate us in some of these issues. Let me ask if you can generalize from your experience, going back to this value of the exchange, the daily contact between visual artists and scientists, to other types of artists and other fields of endeavor, say business or government. Do you think that the value that you and the scientist have gained from this interaction would remain true? You've said you think it would be true for other artists. What about other fields beyond science?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that every large organization should have an artist in residence. What happens a lot of times is with an industrial company, they produce products, or the scientists will be sitting in the back room kind of coming up with interesting plastics or different things like that. And artists love to deal with new materials. And I think artists have been working with new materials since materials have been coming out.
Did you really create a pipe organ out of soda pop bottles?
I did. I was really interested in the way that when you blow on bottles, they make noise. And I had a friend who had perfect pitch, and there's a grocery store nearby that sells 400 or 500 kinds of soda pop, and they're all in bottles. And I had a whole bunch of the bottles sitting around, and she blew on the different bottles and made a scale. And I didn't know anything about music, but I thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you made a pipe organ out of this? And so in my normal fashion, I never know how to do anything that I want to do. I go around and I ask lots of people, and eventually I drew a little drawing and said, well, what do you think that piece is? What do you think that piece is? And through talking to different people, I was able to figure out the different mechanics to make that. And so that was a lot of fun.
I would love to have seen it. And Dan, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, you bet.
Dan Goods is artist in residence at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. You're listening to Smart City. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to sign up for podcasts of our show and register for our weekly newsletter. You can also find archive shows at our site. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.